Really big question today. Huge question. Is God fair? Stephen Cole was on a website. It's kind of an interesting website if you ever want to look it up. It's called Bible.org. It has all kinds of little things on it. But he writes about a situation that you and I, we can all understand. This is what he said. Doesn't it just seem unfair? Especially if you're on the receiving end. Recently, I applied for health insurance. The company accepted me but charged me a higher rate because of my allergy problems. The application never asked whether I smoked or how much. I don't smoke. They didn't ask me if I regularly downed a six-pack and then get behind the wheel. I don't drink at all. They never bothered to inquire of me if I ate properly and exercised regularly. I do. So some guy who smokes two packs a day, drives while drunk, eats junk food, and never exercises gets the standard rate. But because I have hay fever, I have to pay more. I cried out, unfair. Then he goes on to say, we all want to be treated fairly. Most of us figure that if we do our best, God will deal with us fairly on Judgment Day. But Jesus taught that God does not operate according to our notion of what is fair. Matthew chapter 20. Jesus told a very powerful story, a parable, about a man who owned a vineyard. Early in the morning, he went to the town square and hired some workers to go into the vineyard and work. He agreed to pay them the going rate for a day's labor. So they started working. About 9 o'clock, he went and found even more workers standing around idly, and he told them that he would pay them a fair wage if they came and worked for him, and so they went to work in the vineyard. The same thing happened at noon and again at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And finally, even at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, he went and he found other men who were not working and he hired them and sent them all into the vineyard. At sundown, he told his foreman to bring all the workers in so that he could pay them. Begin with those who were hired last, he said. And so for their hour or so of work, they received a full day's wage. So did everybody else, including the ones who were hired first thing in the morning. Everyone received a full day's wage no matter how long they worked in that vineyard. Those who had worked all day, well, you can guess, they weren't happy. They grumbled. They didn't think it was fair that they got paid the same as those who went in and only worked an hour. It wasn't a union shop. Sorry, Jay. They thought they would get more because they had been there longer. But the owner of the vineyard said, "What's your gripe? You got the day's wage that we agreed on when you came and worked for me. If I want to give the same wage to someone who didn't work as long as you did, that's my business." And the main point of the parable is that God does not operate on the merit system that we think he should. God deals with us according to his free grace. As Paul explains, "For it is by his grace you are saved through trusting him. It is not your own doing. It is God's gift, not a reward for work done. There is nothing for anyone to boast of." This concept of God's fairness is the basis for Elihu's second speech. His speech is actually divided into two sections. The verses 2 to 15, Elihu is speaking to a wider audience, meaning anyone who is within earshot. It's not a stretch, I don't think, to think that as time went on, this little gathering on the garbage heap gathered other people's attention and they began to circle around these men. Maybe it was other elders of the community that came. The questions that were raised in this ongoing debate on the rubbish heap were questions that everyone asked from time to time. The second section of this particular speech is directed specifically at Job. And in both sections, Elihu is saying basically the same thing. But the second session, or section, is fuller and it's a more personal appeal. At the very heart of Elihu's words is the concept of grace. Now, some people get really surprised to learn that grace operates in the Old Testament. But you know, grace is everywhere in the Bible, Old and New Testament. God has, since He made us, been demonstrating His grace to people, not delivering us what we deserve. Maybe a true story about grace will bring it home for you and I. Just over a century ago, there was a man named Shamel who was the leader of a guerrilla group fighting against the Tsarist regime in Russia. The unity of his little group was threatened by a rash of stealing amongst the members of the group, which included soldiers' families. So Shamel imposed a penalty of 100 lashes for anyone who was caught stealing. Not long after that proclamation, Shamel's own mother was caught stealing. He didn't know what to do. He loved his mother and didn't want her to suffer. But he also knew that he had to uphold the law or anarchy would rule amongst the group. He shut himself up in a tent for 3 days, agonizing over what to do. Finally, he made up his mind. For the sake of the law and the whole society, his mother must pay the penalty. But before 3 blows had fallen on her back, Shamel had his real and final solution. He removed his mother, and he himself took her place. The full price had to be paid, and he bore the penalty that she deserved. His law stood, but love prevailed. Even if you're a pretty good person, you're one of the ones that have been in the vineyard working since early in the morning, still you violated God's holy law in some way. You've got sin that needs to be paid for. Maybe the person coming at 5 o'clock in the afternoon may have more sin than you do, at least in our minds. But if God is just, both people's sin has to be paid for. Either you pay for it, which is the merit system, or God pays for it, which is the grace system. You know, God's grace, the concept of God's grace, it just doesn't seem fair to people who are self-righteous. But for those who recognize how undeserving they are, it is a truly wonderful thing. Perhaps we need to heed Elihu's invitation to ponder God's governance of the world and whether God governs fairly and justly. You see, we know how Job stands on this issue. Many times throughout the book of Job, Job has accused God of being unjust and unfair to him. Job believes he's being treated like a liar and that no matter what Job says to God, his suffering continues. We know that at the end of the book, that Job will repent of his attitude and also of his accusations towards God. It's interesting to note that Elihu doesn't care one whit about the supposed secret sins that Job is being punished for, and that the other 3 friends accused him of committing. Elihu is more concerned with the obvious sin that Job has been committing all along in this discussion with the friends. Elihu says that Job has been drinking up scoffing water. It means Job has scoffed at the goodness and justice of God. By scoffing at God, Job has aligned himself with evildoers and the wicked. Now, Elihu is not saying that Job is wicked, but rather that Job is speaking like a wicked person. Elihu points out that Job has said that God cares not for the behavior of people. The wicked prosper and the righteous fall, Job has said. Therefore, Job has concluded, well, why be good at all? It doesn't seem to matter, he says. This vision of God that Job is promoting is Job's sin. And it's not hidden at all. Elihu and the other three friends have been privy to this sin right from the get-go. And it's only now Elihu calls him out on it. Like any one of us who has seen or heard a person who's down in the dumps get reprimanded, sometimes Elihu's words feel like he's being uncaring. He's being harsh. But again, that's our human perspective. It's not God's perspective. Elihu is like the prophets that will follow in the Bible. He is demonstrating an overwhelming passion for the honor of God. So Elihu moves from presenting his own take on Job's circumstance and Job's response. Once again, we see here that asking the question why is the wrong question to ask when we are in dire straits. When bad things happen to us, we should never ask why, but instead we should ask, now that this has happened to me, what am I going to do about it? So Elihu presents his main thesis in two ways. One is negative and one is positive. The negative approach is that Elihu cannot abide the idea that God would ever do wickedness. Positively, Elihu affirms the doctrine of just judgment in that God does repay people fairly and does justly repay them according to their ways. This was the heart of Job's denial, wasn't it? Job denied the goodness of God because he felt that God was punishing him unfairly. Earlier, his friends expressed a similar thought that God retains his punishment for the wicked. But Elihu takes that idea and he just broadens it wide open. God is not only just in his punishment, but also good and fair in the governance of the world. Why is it unthinkable that God would act wickedly, we might wonder? Well, Elihu's main point is in verses 13 to 15. They're at the very heart of all of this. It is unthinkable to think of God as being wicked because God is God. God is above all other gods. God is the one who made the world. God is the one who maintains the world. And if God is unjust, well then frankly, there's no justice at all. If there's anything like justice in the world, it's because it has originated from God. God made justice. And Elihu drives the point home, reminding Job that we're utterly dependent on God for our very life and our breath. God, however, needs nothing from any one of us. Nothing. To challenge God's justice is to attack God's character. And this is foolish and a dangerous endeavor, Elihu says. Job, in his words and his attitude, is challenging God's very character. Job and anyone who thinks like him is wrong. Because God is supremely powerful and cannot be influenced by anyone to have God show them favoritism. judgment's not uncertain. Elihu says, in the moment they die, which doesn't mean immediate death of a wicked person, but rather God is at work 24/7 in this world. God also judges with perfect judgment because he sees all. No one can hide from God. You know, I don't know if you've noticed, if you follow in the newspaper, we humans, we can take a long time to investigate someone's guilt or innocence. Sometimes it takes years for a case to get to the court, but not for God. He can execute judgment whenever he deems it necessary. Elihu also states that God judges publicly for all of us to see. People are given over to their wickedness to receive what they deserve. This is a point I've been pondering a lot of late. You know, there is a lot of wickedness perpetrated in this world. I don't have to tell you that. You all know. Have you noticed lately that even wickedness that was committed decades ago is now being revealed? And people and institutions are being held to account for their wickedness. For Canadians, at least for me, there was a blind spot when it came to the whole residential school system for Aboriginal children. Honestly, I didn't know anything about it until the last few years. And I'm appalled by what happened to those children. The light is beginning to shine there in the darkness. The same goes for the Me Too movement and the Black Lives Matter movement. Now, I don't have any easy solutions for these miscarriages of justice. But now I am certainly more aware of them and can become an ally with those who are grievously wounded. I also want to mention that there's a real catharsis or release for people when they can share their pain freely and without judgment. So Elihu comes to the climax of his argument. Even when God seems quiet to us, it is still unacceptable and wrong to condemn God for his apparent injustice. For when he hides his face, that is, he's invisible to us, we have no idea what's going on behind the scenes. That was what really happened at the beginning of the story, isn't it? We got to look behind the curtain, but we don't often get that chance. But this also applies to our personal situation. It applies globally. God's apparent inaction does not contradict his justice. God's slowness to act from our perspective is no grounds to deny his sovereignty, nor his justice. It is therefore logical that Elihu now moves to call Job to repentance, to admit before God he has said things he shouldn't have said. Even under such duress as he has experienced in his life, Job needs to trust God. It's God's plan for him that really matters. If God had admitted Job's accusations were correct, then it would be Job's wisdom and Job's sense of justice that would have been controlling reality and not God. Some commentators suggest that Elihu got to verse 33 and he kind of paused. And he waited to see what kind of response Job would give him and what response the friends would give him. We cannot say that there was a pause for certain, but the point is clear that Elihu has taken this matter of Job's poor thinking and speech about God with the utmost care and concern. Elihu has suggested that Job has spoken without knowledge and he has spoken without insight. What we say, therefore, about God and his justice and his goodness is of prime importance to every one of us. Elihu states that Job has added rebellion to his sin. Literally, he has clapped his hands among us and multiplies his words against God. Elihu is suggesting that Job has undermined the piety of his three friends. He's caused them to stumble. Clapping his hands may indicate that Job has made an impious or rude gesture in response to what Elihu has said. You see, Job hasn't said just one bad thing about God, but rather, for the whole book, he's gone on and on and on with dispersions about God. It has been a sustained attack on the good character of God. Elihu believes that despite his suffering, Job needs to repent of his words and his attitude. We may be tempted to look at Elihu's words and consider them to be cruel and self-serving arrogance or insensitivity to someone who was so grievously wounded. I doubt any one of us would go to sit with a friend who had been through something terrible like that and had been just as harsh with them. But we miss the point. If we dismiss Elihu's words because of our perceived harshness of them. Yeah, his words are harsh. They are blunt. But there's a good reason for it. You see, the reason is he's taken this seriously. Very seriously. He fears that Job, in his false view of God, is endangering himself to a final judgment and punishment. He wants Job to forego his complaint to God and simply submit himself to God in all things, despite what happens to him. To believe we know better than God in whatever circumstance we are in is to align ourselves with the serpent in the Garden of Eden. Tempted the first couple with the promise of self-awareness of wisdom. The serpent tempted Adam and Eve to become like God. Job's friends have missed this vital point because they were so focused on the sins that Job committed before the tragedy that they missed the sin that was going on right in front of them. The three friends had no way to validate their assertion of Job's wickedness. It was all supposition. But Elihu sees the true sin in all of this, and he calls Job to account. It therefore all comes down to our willingness to submit all things to God. No easy task, given our egos and our self-pride. But to refuse to submit is the absolute height of folly. You know, this story, I love this story. There was a captain of a battleship who was commanding his ship through a very dark night. And in the distance he saw the faint lights of something. Immediately he told a single signal man to send a message out to that light saying, alter your course 10 degrees south. Promptly a return message was received, alter your course 10 degrees north. Well, the captain was angry. He commanded, his command had been ignored. So he sent a second message, alter your course 10 degrees south. I am the captain. Soon another message came. Alter your course 10 degrees north. I am a seaman, third class Jones. Immediately, the captain sent a third message, knowing the fear it would invoke. Alter your course 10 degrees south. I am a battleship. Then came the reply. Alter your course 10 degrees north. I'm a lighthouse. In the midst of our dark and foggy times, all sorts of voices are going to be shouting at us, shouting orders at us in the night, telling us what to do, how to adjust our lives. But out of the darkness, one voice signals something quite opposite to all the rest. Something almost absurd. But the voice happens to be the light of the world. And we ignore it to our peril.